Good evening and welcome to this special Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report. On today's program, we'll have additional coverage of the December 18th Poverty on the Palouse Forum, covering communications initiatives for fighting poverty. But first, this news. The legislature's Interim Committee on Employment Compensation voted today to recommend 2% raises for state employees for fiscal year 2015. That would include a 1% permanent pay increase and another 1% increase representing a one-time bonus. The recommendation comes on the heels of Monday's State of the State address, in which Governor C.L. Butch Otter recommended no pay increases for the 24,000 state employees because of the increasing cost of health care coverage. Since then, numerous lawmakers have expressed concern about pay raises because a Hay Group study found state workers in Idaho are paid 10% less than the normal wages for similar work in nearby states and 19% behind the pay rate given in the private sector for similar work. In addition, the last state employee raise, which was 2% in fiscal year 2013, came 3 years after the state cut pay 5% in 2010. The Compensation Committee voted 17-0 on a motion by co-chair Representative Neil Anderson of Blackfoot. Here's Anderson making the motion this afternoon.
The Joint CEC Committee recommends the following, and then we've spelled out here certain steps. The first step in this particular motion is to move the pay grid up 1%. And if we do that, it affects the folks that are at the very bottom of that pay grid. There's about 382 people. They're making essentially the minimum wage that the state authorizes for that particular pay level. And so by moving that pay level up 1%, it moves their pay up 1% automatically. People that are already in that pay grid at a higher level, assuming they're more than 1% above the minimum, would not be affected. The total cost to do that is about $99,000 to the general fund, and it would then entail about another $20,000 to be paid from other sources, that dedicated money or federal money. Secondly, would continue the job classifications that are currently on the pay line exception. In other words, people that we have made exceptions for because they're in difficult to fill position, we would continue with that policy. There's not any extra funding allocated toward it, but it's something that we feel like we need to fully staff our state government. C, as you can see, would be an indication that we would authorize here a 1% salary increase for state employees, and that would be at the discretion of the directors to allocate that within their various departments. We also allocate, in addition to that, because that would be what I would view as permanent money. And the other one would be another 1% in addition to that in the form of a bonus. So we're agreeing to pay that for a year. Somewhere in this you'll see that we're suggesting that this CEC committee meet annually. So we kind of make a commitment to do that. If the economy is doing well in a year, then that CEC committee that meets at that point may choose to extend that bonus, or they may not. But at least we have the option to protect the state to some degree from making commitments that we can't meet long term, depending on what happens with the economy. Article D here says funding of approximately $12.7 million from the general fund to pay for these things. On the back of the page, we've got number two, for those agencies funded in total or in part from non-general fund money, the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee is requested. So this is a recommendation to appropriate in or nearly as possible the same manner as agencies funded by the general fund. Article 3 would say that the Joint CEC Committee also finds that investing in state employee compensation should remain a high priority, even in tough economic times, and therefore encourages agency directors, institution executives, and Division of Financial Management to approve the use of salary savings to provide either one-time or ongoing merit increases for deserving employees and also target employees who are below policy compensation. In other words, we acknowledge that that is going on, that probably at least there's sentiment on the part of many to address that going forward in a separate venue. Such salary savings could result from turnover and attrition or be the result of innovation and reorganization efforts that create savings. So we're relying on our directors to use their management skills to maximize the return to the taxpayer and the citizens. Such savings should be reinvested in employees. Agencies are cautioned to use one-time funding for one-time payments and ongoing funding for permanent pay increases. The Division of Human Resources and the Division of Financial Management shall ensure that agency institution compensation policies are managed consistent with the policies contained herein. Number five, appropriation measures to fund non-classified employees should be prepared in, as nearly as possible, the same manner as for classified employees. And again, we suggest reconvening the Joint CEC Committee during the 2015 legislative session as well.
That was Republican Representative Neil Anderson of Blackfoot, who also co-chairs the State Committee on Employment Compensation, making his motion before the Committee on Employment Compensation this afternoon. During debate leading up to the vote, Democratic Senator Dan Schmidt of Moscow noted he has a unique perspective as the only member of the committee who also serves on both the legislature's Economic Outlook Committee and the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee.
We have just finished our Economic Outlook review, which has been interesting, and just in watching the demeanor of that committee, I sense that there was a tepid belief that we're raising expectations, we're climbing out of a hole, and I sense that in this motion. And so, to me, I think this motion appropriately reflects what we consider our duty as stewards for our state services that we're shepherds over. And I think this is an appropriate but tentative move. And given the fact that we need to pay our bills, I expect we will be able to pay this, and I think it's an appropriate move, so I'll be supporting this motion.
State Senator Dan Schmidt of Moscow. Democratic Representative Phyllis King of Boise said, with increased health insurance costs, the 1% raise will cover that, but result in no increase in take-home pay for state workers. King said, with a 2% raise, state employees would actually see an increase in take-home pay. Republican Representative Jim Guthrie of McCammon said the committee should just recommend a 2% permanent pay raise instead of making half of the raise a one-time bonus. Guthrie said, I think if we're going to step up and do 2% for state employees, we need to do it ongoing. But if I'm the only one that feels this way, I'll likely support the motion. The vote in favor of the 2% employee pay raise recommendation, half of which would be permanent and the other half a one-time bonus, was unanimous. The Hay Group had recommended a 3% pay raise in a newly completed study, but Governor Otter had recommended no pay raise for fiscal year 2015 in his State of the State address Monday. The Idaho Board of Correction voted today to officially order the State Department of Correction to take over operations of the Idaho Correctional Center south of Boise next year. The state-owned prison is currently operated under a $29 million annual contract with the largest private prison company in the U.S., Corrections Corporation of America, but has been plagued with timesheet fraud and lawsuits over inadequate supervision of inmates, leading to violence. Correction Board Chair Robin Sandy said after 2 years of state management, the board could evaluate how it's working and decide on a future management strategy for the prison. Currently, all other state prisons are operated by the Department of Correction. The National Weather Service has issued a high wind warning for the Spokane area and a flood watch for the Palouse and surrounding areas to the north, west, and south. The Toulouse and surrounding areas will also be under a high wind advisory between 4 a.m. tomorrow and 4 a.m. Sunday. Wind gusts on Saturday night could reach up to 55 miles per hour on the Palouse, strong enough to lead to scattered power outages and downed trees. Those traveling in high-profile vehicles should take the wind advisory into consideration. The flood watch for the region will be in effect until tomorrow night as warm rains and winds arrive in the area this evening. The flood watch is in effect for small streams and urban areas in all of northern Idaho and much of eastern Washington. Two studies of health service needs for the region have found the area is lacking in mental health and cancer services. Pullman Memorial Hospital Marketing Director Megan Guido outlined the results of a statewide survey by the Washington Hospital Association and Association of Public Hospitals and a regional survey done online by Pullman Memorial Hospital. According to an account in the Daily News, Guido told the hospital board Wednesday the survey results confirmed what health officials had known for a long time. Local cancer patients must go to Lewiston for a weekly satellite clinic for oncology or radiation care, or go to clinics in Coeur d'Alene or Spokane. There is also a major cancer center in Seattle. Hospital board member and oncology nurse Sandra O'Keefe said radiation treatments are often given 5 days in a row for 5 or 6 weeks. I hate to think of them having to drive that on a regular basis, especially during the winter. Idaho's new health insurance exchange has shown significant growth since last month. According to the Associated Press, only 1,730 Idahoans enrolled through November 30th. New figures show almost 20,000 people bought insurance plans for individuals and families in time for Your Health Idaho coverage starting January 1st of this year. Your Health Idaho spokesperson Jody Olson was cautious in her wording. Speaking to the Your Health Idaho board, Olson said, "We do not have any official numbers." She added the latest numbers are anecdotal and hopes for more solid figures next week. However, insurance agent Rudy Ballard of Rexburg told the Associated Press in late December most of the new enrollees have been insured before and few new policies went to previously uninsured people. Ballard said many did not even know they are supposed to buy insurance. The uninsured are the main targets of the Federal Affordable Health Care Act, signed into law by President Barack Obama in 2010. Ballard said almost all of them have been insured before. Those people that were uninsured, when I talked to them at my little Walmart booth, they had no idea. What do you mean I have to have insurance? This week, the Portland Parks Bureau turned down Portland Hemp Stocks application for a use permit to allow the festival to take place in Waterfront Park this coming September. Yesterday, the Portland City Council upheld that decision. The rejection came after city officials said event organizers failed to manage traffic, litter, and drug use during the event last year. After an unnamed man threw a copy of the Bill of Rights at Mayor Charlie Hales and Commissioner Amanda Fritz, council members said event organizers may submit another application which outlines how a drug-free event can be enforced, including bag checks for those entering the park. Last year, the event drew an estimated 80,000 people in North Portland. The event's growth has, according to police, not been matched by efforts to manage the event. Police complained the event was nothing more than a drug fest and said there were many minors smoking pot, even though organizers had promised a drug-free event. Police and parks officials said there were not enough toilets and trash removal efforts as well. Hempstock founder Paul Stanford said he wants to work with city officials to ensure a peaceful event. Stanford said he's okay with a bag search as event goers enter the park, but does not want random searches by police during the event. Organizers said bringing the event back into Waterfront Park in downtown Portland would reduce traffic congestion as festival goers could use public transit to the event. The first two events were held downtown in 2005 and 2006. Washington State University announced the School of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science's new online master's degree program in electrical power engineering yesterday. WSU program coordinator Bob Olson told the Daily News the two-year program will be multifaceted. Olson said the nice thing about this particular degree is that it covers technical topics and also professional topics. The program includes finance, analysis of power systems, transmission lines and power markets, and project management. The program also covers the law as it applies to electrical power industry. An internship is also required for the two-year program. Olson said the program was discussed as a way to help fill a growing gap in the country's engineering workforce because in recent years, universities have been cutting electrical engineering programs in favor of computer engineering and software development type programs, which has led to fewer qualified graduates ready to enter electrical engineering careers. According to Olson, a large chunk of the nation's electrical engineers are reaching retirement age, and companies like Avista and Schweitzer Engineering Laboratories are searching to fill the void when those workers leave. We now turn to our featured segment. On December 18th, the Poverty on the Palouse Forum held another in its series of updates. We now bring you the segment on communications, starting with then Moscow Mayor Nancy Cheney.
Those people who have needs for services and those people who have the capacity to provide those, to meet those needs, have to figure out how to talk to each other effectively. We have organizations that are replicating one another's services unnecessarily. We have some opportunities for leveraging our respective resources more efficiently than we have. And I think we've improved that over time. There were a lot of networks happening that I didn't even know about. I didn't know about the work of Community Action on the Palouse or the Human Needs Council. I wasn't aware of some of the meetings going on at the Department of Health and Welfare. So I think we have really a chance to enhance awareness, not only among ourselves, but the general public and those who would come to our community seeking resources that could assist individuals and families. So I put together this chart just as a starting place, yet again, another threshold to talk about. A couple of models that we discussed. And I'll ask your feedback on each of these. One was a model that Steve Bonner brought back from a visit he made in Coeur d'Alene, where they actually have a physical location as a one-stop shop where all these agencies and nonprofits can come together. They have offices or desks set up in this common area, and they can have face-to-face interaction among the service providers and the clients that they might cross-refer. But the cons to that possible solution, at least as we have discussed preliminarily, had to do with having to pay rent probably, possibly having to have redundant staffing, threats to continued congressional support for things like the Community Development Block Grant Program, which is presently funding that program in Coeur d'Alene, and whether the site might become a need for or a magnet for high need populations. And I think we always hear that. I mean, even if we're talking about a city park, you know, and recreational events, people say, oh, it'll be a magnet for the riffraff. You know, you can hear that in any setting. So we'd have a need for a convenient location. So if any of you have a site and you just were hankering to have a whole bunch of nonprofits and government agencies come together to be able to have this sort of facility, raise your hand now. But comments about that model as a physical location, as a one-stop shop, anybody like that or dislike that? Yes, Marie.
Well, the centralization of it, having it centralized and knowing that most people who need the services don't have transportation, that would be my concern, that it might be mobile. And so a bicycle with a rider that has a little wagon on the back of it that has like a little kiosk that you can bicycle around different communities, that it goes out to the county communities as well. Or and when the weather's inclement and maybe you don't want to ride your bike all the way out to Derry, we could have a van.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else? Okay. Another idea was a service agency handout listing homelessness resources. I know Krista Kramer had initiated that. Let's see, Krista was here a minute ago. There she is. And was updating that document. It would be printed or perhaps a digital informational document. It's a pretty simple solution. It's familiar to a lot of people. One of the challenges that we discussed was how do you keep that information current and who would be responsible besides Krista for having to update those things. So that document, last time we spoke, Krista, was still under revision. Where are we now on that?
Actually, I don't think I was the one who initiated it. I think the initiation came from St. Vincent de Paul and the Human Needs Council. There is a version of that document in existence now. I don't know how far it has been disseminated. Do you know any more, Mike? No. So it's a topic to revisit and find out. I know there was conversation about an online version that was available through the WSU YMCA, which is a membership version. Therefore, a lot of people don't pay the membership to join to have their organizations listed, so it became a somewhat limited use option for finding out about all of the community resources. And I haven't heard anything from anybody in about 6 months on that front. Anybody know more?
Actually, that is listed on here under the police resource guide.
It is listed on page 2, policeresourceguide.com. And it doesn't cost anyone to access the information there. We did, as the Palouse Resource Network for Families and the Palouse Alliance for Healthy Families and Communities, have been very fortunate that YMCA has taken that on as a project. But again, in order to maintain it, we are looking for people to, what do they call those, Tiffany? It's not a membership, but it's there's different sponsorship levels. Mm-hmm. And
it's to help with the sustainability of that system.
So YMCA has a staff member who is designated to maintain the website and update. So you can do different things to present your agency's information depending on the sponsorship level you pay. But I think the lowest is $60 a year. Does that sound right?
$30
a year. And then we have had some major sponsorships like Gritman Hospital and Medical Center, Pullman Regional, Whitman Hospital.
That help?
Thank you. So one of the challenges might be for some of the faith-based organizations, some of the service groups at area churches, for example, may not be looking to join as a member, but they would have resources they're wanting to offer, and something maybe even like Family Promise, where they're wanting to invest resources in the services provided. And so how do we balance this with the limited dollars available, but recognizing that those sites need to be managed somehow, and there has to be a mechanism for keeping them up to date? We also talked about just a simple Facebook model, and that was brought forward by Chris Hudson. I don't think Chris is here this afternoon, but he's an operations and management and informations major at the University of Idaho. He works with a fraternity there, and because their house, at least for the time being, does not have its charter, they don't have a physical location, they communicate via Facebook, and they have their meetings and are coordinating things in that way. A big advantage of that is that it's scalable, so that you can start small and then see how you can make that Facebook connection expand. One of the challenges, though, is maintaining confidentiality, and many of our organizations are dealing with sensitive issues that must necessarily remain confidential. So it was something that we hoped would be able to work. I know Chris remains enthusiastic. He seems like he just invited me to join him on LinkedIn or something like that. So any thoughts about this kind of virtual connectivity through something that's sort of a like a chat room or a, we used to, in the olden days, we'd have WebCT or Facebook or some of these social networks? Jennifer.
I think it's a great idea, but a problem is that you're assuming that everybody has access to computers. And I don't think that someone who's living in a car out in Troy in July has a computer in the back seat. So it's kind of a...
Okay. And that's an excellent point, because while some of the agencies are tech-savvy, web-savvy, have access to equipment and electricity, that the people who may require those resources or some of our rural communities may not have those things. So that perhaps is a limitation there.
That's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Weather for the Moscow Pullman area, 100% chance of rain tonight, low 41, south winds 10 to 15, becoming south 15 to 20 after midnight with gusts up to 30. Tomorrow, 100% chance of rain, then rain and snow late in the day, high 47, windy, south winds 25 to 35 with gusts up to 45 miles per hour. Little or no snow accumulation expected. On Saturday night, rain and snow before midnight, then a slight chance of snow after 5 a.m., low 33, 90% chance of precipitation, windy, southwest winds 35 with gusts up to 50 miles per hour. And on Sunday, 60% chance of snow before noon, then snow likely possibly mixed with rain, mostly cloudy, high 41, breezy, southwest winds 15 to 25 with gusts up to 35, new snow accumulation less than half an inch possible. It's overcast and 41 degrees. There is a wind advisory in effect until 4 a.m. on Sunday for the entire region, including much of eastern Washington and all of northern Idaho. Winds on Saturday will be from the south or southwest, 25 to 35 miles per hour with gusts up to 55. Winds on Saturday night, 25 to 35 with gusts up to 55. South to southwest winds will develop over the region early Saturday morning as a cold front passes Saturday. Winds will become westerly and remain strong through early Sunday morning. Strong winds could lead to scattered power outages and minor property damage. Strong winds could also lead to travel difficulties for high-profile vehicles. There also is a flood watch in effect for all of northern Idaho and much of eastern Washington. That will be in effect through Saturday afternoon. A warm tropical system will move through the inland northwest beginning this afternoon and leaving tomorrow evening, bringing warm wind and rain. The greatest amount of rainfall will be in the Idaho Panhandle, the eastern slopes of the Cascades, and the Blue Mountains. Snow levels will be high during the event, up to 5,000 feet in the Cascades and up to 7,000 feet in the Panhandle and the Blues. Rain amounts will be 1.5 inches in areas of the eastern slopes of the Cascades and 1 inch forecast for the Idaho Panhandle and the Blue Mountains. Runoff from the rain and snowmelt will be enhanced in many areas where the ground is still frozen. The flood watch does not pertain to rivers, but pertains to small streams and also overflowing ditches, drains, and culverts may become clogged, and there could be ponding of water on roads and other low-lying areas that are prone to stormwater flooding. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on Radio Free Moscow, you can become a member of Radio Free Moscow. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the Radio Free Moscow website to find out more ways to help Radio Free Moscow. Jim Roach and Joe Campbell assisted with tonight's newscast. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a great weekend.